6. Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Pippin Ross. Bill Littlefield is on vacation. On Monday, Baltimore Orioles pitcher Steve Beckler died of heat stroke. Even though the toxicology report won't be final for a couple of weeks, the speculation is that Beckler's demise was hastened by ephedra, the main ingredient in dozens of over-the-counter drugs. The 6'2", 249-pound, 23-year-old was taking ephedra-filled Xenadrine RF1 to lose weight. He collapsed during training in Fort Lauderdale. 24 hours later, he was dead. On Wednesday, teammate Matt Riley struggled to explain Beckler's death.
We've had a lot hotter days, and I've seen him run on a lot hotter days, and that's what's so hard to grasp is why and what did this.
Beckler was reportedly struggling with his preseason conditioning. He had failed to complete several running drills. His troubles did not escape Orioles manager Mike Hargrove.
He was overweight, but not sloppily overweight. I mean, he wasn't a slob. He was hairier than he needed to be, and there were things that he needed to address, and we discussed those.
Beckler reported to camp about 10 pounds over last year's playing weight. Doctors suspect that the ephedra in his system, along with several other pre-existing physical ailments, including high blood pressure and liver problems, combined to overheat his body to a staggering 108 degrees on a humid 80-degree day. Dr. Joshua Perper is the Broward County medical examiner who performed the autopsy.
Ephedrine is a drug which is not supposed to be taken by individuals who have heart problems such as hypertension or who have liver problems. And with all those kinds of risk factors, Mr. Beckler unfortunately was also exposed to hot temperature and high humidity while he was exercising. So all those factors really worked together against him and unfortunately caused his tragic death.
Perper joins a growing legion of medical experts urging baseball to follow the lead of the NCAA, the NFL, and the International Olympic Committee. All three organizations have banned the use of ephedra. And now the Food and Drug Administration is launching an investigation into the herbal stimulant, which is among hundreds of so-called food supplements that were approved for sale when Congress passed the Dietary Supplement Health Education Act, known as DSHEA. Dr. Arthur Grohlman is an outspoken critic of the legislation, and he's active in lobbying for its repeal.
This just opened the door for problems, and the problems have certainly occurred, the ephedra being one of the most dramatic, but certainly not the only one. There's no reason for anybody in the United States to take an herbal supplement. They can buy this over the counter. They do buy it over the counter. And, of course, this accounts for the literally tens of thousands of adverse effects and literally thousands of deaths since the passage of DSHEA just from ephedra supplements alone.
But for athletes like Beckler and thousands of consumers, the possibility of losing a few pounds often outweighs the potential risks. Besides, says Men's Health magazine editor Greg Stebbin, not everyone heeds warning labels.
When you buy something at a health food store, like a weight loss product like this, it's kind of easy to trick yourself into thinking, oh, it came from a health food store, so it must be healthy. And it's regardless of whether it kills you or not, an artificial stimulant that comes from the amphetamine family is probably not healthy under any circumstances.
Apparently, Major League Baseball owners agree. Whether or not ephedra is banned by the Food and Drug Administration, Major League Baseball owners, led by the Orioles' Peter Angelos, are calling once again for the drug to be banned in baseball. For the second time in a week, America's Cup sailing was called off last night due to light, shifty winds on New Zealand's Hauraki Gulf. The break comes as a disappointment to New Zealand fans who are still waiting for their team to win a race against the Swiss syndicate, Alinghi. Ironically, Alinghi is led by Russell Coutts, the Kiwi who led New Zealand to victory in the last two America's Cup finals. Joining us on the line from Auckland to fill us in on the latest Cup tacks and jibes is Stuart Stroily, senior editor for Sailing World magazine. Stuart, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks. It's great to be back on the show.
When New Zealand lost the first two races, experts pointed out that boats had come back from a 2-0 start three times in America's Cup history. Then, of course, things went from bad to worse for the Kiwis. Can New Zealand come back from their 3-0 deficit?
Well, that remains to be seen. They've made a key change in their afterguard in the back of the boat, the sailors who make the decisions. They've removed Hamish Pepper, who's a native New Zealander and a good friend of skipper Dean Barker, and replaced him with Bertrand Passe, a French veteran of four America's Cup campaigns for France and has been sailing with Team New Zealand this last campaign as their trial boat skipper, essentially as Barker's sparring partner. He's a feisty sailor, he's very aggressive, and he's very experienced. He is a guy that could inject some enthusiasm into the team. He also is a guy that may be able to take them to the next level as far as aggressiveness. Russell Coutts is not a guy that you can beat by sitting back and expecting your boat speed to win out over him, especially in this regatta. He's a guy you've got to attack, and Bertrand Passe is just the guy to attack Russell Coutts. He's not afraid of anyone.
Before the races began, everyone was talking about New Zealand's hula hull design, and this was expected to make the boat very fast, especially in heavy winds. Except for the first race, in which the Kiwis were really hobbled by mechanical problems, has their boat been performing as expected?
Well, I think the boat's been performing well. I think that people were probably wrong to expect that the Alinghi syndicate with Coutts and Butterworth and designer Rolf Rolick and design coordinator Grant Simmer would not be able to produce a superior boat. They have really produced an extremely refined machine. And while it may not have the gimmick of the hula to add waterline length and still help their sail area, it's still a very fast boat. And I think that what you're seeing is the Kiwis have produced a very solid boat. It's a great boat, and it moves well on all points of sail and appears to move well in all wind conditions. The Kiwi boat has been sailing well, but so has the Swiss boat.
And the Swiss boat, the Alinghi, also got to race against some tough competition for months during the preliminaries. While the Kiwis had to kind of settle for practicing on their own, has competing in the preliminaries turned into an advantage then for Alinghi?
There's no doubt about it, and everyone on the Alinghi syndicate will tell you that. Alinghi have faced eight other challengers, and even the challenge they faced, for example, Oracle, whom they faced in the semifinals and then again in the finals, they faced virtually different boats in those semifinals. They were forced, those two races, so they were forced to learn different things about the boat and how to attack the boat. And this has all helped their ability to think on the fly. They are able to assess an opponent's weaknesses and strengths very quickly, and then they're able to figure out how they can take advantage of them around the race course.
How have the locals been taking the losses?
Well, to be honest, I think most of them are taking it very well, and most of them realize that this is a game. It's also a business, though, and they respect Russell Coutts for his superior preparation and just his amazing efforts in this campaign. But there certainly have been a few instances of what is definitely poor sportsmanship. There were rumors that some patrons wearing Alinghi flagged clothing were not served at an Auckland restaurant the other night. The restaurant manager or one of the people in the restaurant told them that they do not serve Alinghi people. There have also been some instances a little bit more serious of Team New Zealand supporters in smaller boats harassing Alinghi boats that are coming back into the harbor. The people here are certainly not happy to see this trophy go, and some of them are taking it probably a little too seriously.
You've really heaped a lot of praise on Russell Coutts as unbeatable on the Hauraki Gulf. But if Alinghi does win, the Cup would go back to Europe, where Coutts doesn't have a lifetime of sailing experience and might have a better chance of losing. Are potential challengers looking forward to that possibility?
I'm not sure if anyone's really figured out where Coutts has a weakness, but it certainly isn't on the Hauraki Gulf, so it couldn't hurt to sail somewhere else. I think challengers, however, are lining up because of the advantages that Europe offers, especially for corporate sponsorship and for general mass public appeal. there's just no comparison between this small country and the other side of the world and Europe, which is so close to so many things and has so much economic wealth. So I think the challengers are really eager to get started on that campaign and see what sort of sponsors they can drum up and see how many teams they can get. You know, people are talking in excess of 12 to 15 challengers for a cup should it go to Europe. And that would really be an amazing draw for this regatta and could do a ton to boost its worldwide popularity and really expose the sport to a whole new audience.
So, gosh, any ideas yet as to where the next cup would be held if the landlocked Swiss win is predicted?
Well, certainly won't be Switzerland. They've had a number of
no.
they've had a number of offers from ports around Europe. A lot of people in the media center would seem to favor Lisbon because we think we get better wind there and we get some really good sailing conditions, and it's also kind of a nice city that would really embrace the cup. But that it could easily go to the Mediterranean, to Marseille. Bertarelli is, I believe he has some Italian roots, and he mentioned interest in holding in Italy. So the options are really up in the air. The general consensus right now is that Bertarelli, if he wins the cup, will wait about 6 to 9 months to officially announce a port, and during that time he's going to take offers and assess their potential and see where he thinks the best place is for him to hold the cup.
Stuart Stroily is the senior editor for Sailing World magazine. Stuart, thanks for speaking with me.
You're welcome. It's great to be on the show.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. John Smith, also known as the Flying Farmer, is in the news and in the Guinness Book of World Records again. Last weekend, the 38-year-old daredevil from Makati, North Dakota, jumped a car over 25 hay bales, a distance of more than 160 feet. Smith escaped bodily harm, even though his car landed nose first on the frozen ground and nearly flipped over. Smith said when he told his wife, Melinda, about his plans to jump their 25 unsold hay bales last month, she kind of chuckled. But she's not chuckling anymore.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The Boston Bruins dropped last night's game to the Devils in New Jersey. To find out more NHL and NBA scores from Friday, go to WBUR.org, click on News, and then on Sports. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. And Century 21 Fine Homes and Estates. More information on their luxury listings is available at century21.com/MA. Century 21, real estate for the real world. And J.N. Phillips Auto Glass, featuring 57 years of experience, 40 locations, 120 mobile vans, and industry-certified technicians. Committed to safe installation standards. 1-877-AUTO-GLASS. It's 720.
I'm Pippin Ross. Bill Littlefield is on hiatus this week as he prepares his 38-volume history of women's soccer. Ahead on Only a Game, I attack a mountain with a plank. But first, the earliest female mountain climbers faced extraordinary challenges, not just cliff and crevasse, but the constraints of a Victorian society that believed women should not exert themselves. Joining me from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio is Rebecca Brown, author of Women on High, Pioneers of Mountaineering. Welcome to Only a Game, Rebecca.
Hi, Pippin. It's great to be here.
Now, you've chronicled a dozen or so women mountain climbers in this book, most of whom made their various and pretty impressive assaults in the 1800s and the early 1900s. But what's especially impressive is that this was a time when really the only acceptable climb for a woman was, you know, up a flight of stairs.
That's right. It was pretty remarkable that some of these women decided to leave the comfort of home and hearth and not only climb mountains that were high and fearsome and pretty much unknown, but many of them climbed mountains that had never been climbed before. And some of them even did it in winter when very few people were out there climbing.
Now, we're talking about some serious climbs here, the 19,000-foot Huascarán in Peru, California's 14,000-foot Mount Shasta, the Matterhorn, that's also about 14,000 feet. Very snowy, all with no maps, no real gear, no proper clothing. Describe for us some of the things that they would typically bring along or wear.
Well, at that time, of course, they didn't have the advantage that we have of hindsight. So they were using the best gear and equipment that was available. But at the time, mountaineering was just beginning to become a sport in that people were doing it for fun. The equipment that they were using was very rudimentary by our standards. They used long sticks with iron pieces on the end called alpenstocks, and those gradually evolved into ice axes. Even crampons, which we use today, we strap them on our boots to work on ice and hard snow. Crampons were still a radical innovation up until the last part of the 19th century. But women were probably most disadvantaged because of their dress and the actual long skirts that they were expected to wear.
Now, what kind of a handicap did that pose?
Well, when you figure that these skirts were made of wool, and then there were several layers underneath, depending on the time of year, that would also be made of wool flannel. They could be wearing just on their body, forget about carrying a pack, as much as 20 pounds.
Wow.
And once that skirt and the other dress, their tops, got wet, it could be easily double that amount. And then in winter, and if it's frozen, it must have felt like a sheet of armor.
Now, you actually have a couple of stories in which women ditched their dresses.
As they started climbing more, this is into the middle part of the century and then beyond, into the 1870s and 80s, women started giving each other some tips on what to do in the mountains and how to dress specifically. And they tried to balance practicality and femininity. And the advice that one of the most famous mountaineers gave her colleagues was, you can take your skirt off and put it under a rock or give it to your guide and let him carry it after you leave civilization. And you can proceed on your climb wearing knickers. And these are rock climbs, so you need your unencumbered hands and feet to do these climbs. And then once the climb is over and you've returned, you can pick up your skirt and put it back on and return to your village.
Now, a lot of these women are credited with being actually the pioneers of ice and snow climbing and also winter camping, even predating men who did the same things, which seems extraordinary considering the complete lack of equipment.
Well, they were doing it along with men at that time, mm-hmm. but one of the women who really started winter mountaineering was a woman named Elizabeth LeBlond, who was an English woman who was sent to Switzerland for her health, of all things. She had tuberculosis, or as they called it at that time, consumption. Mm. And her family wanted her to breathe in the clean Swiss air. And she started climbing and found that she just really enjoyed it and was very, very good at it. And then winter rolled around, and she kind of looked about, and she said, there's really nothing to do, so why not do it in the winter? And she ended up writing the world's first book dedicated to winter mountaineering in 1883.
When you did your research, did you find that you ended up having a favorite mountain climber?
So many of these women have wonderful stories, and each of them is quite delightful and rather eccentric in her own way. So it's hard to pick a favorite. But I think the most compelling story to me was that of Annie Smith Peck, who was the first woman to organize a climb to one of the world's major peaks and actually succeeded at doing it, and that was Mount Huascarán in Peru.
Why was she your favorite?
First of all, she was one of the very few mountaineers, male or female, who didn't come from a lot of money. which meant that she had to raise the funds for her expeditions herself. And that meant that she had to convince people that she wasn't totally out of her mind. And she had a hard time of it. She was a single woman. As I said, she did not come from means. And she was very creative in going about what she wanted to do. Very forceful, very driven, competitive. She started her life, or her professional life, as a classicist. And it wasn't until her middle age that she actually discovered the Alps, with the Matterhorn in particular. She wanted to climb it. She didn't have the money to do so. It took her 10 years, and she returned at the age of 45 and climbed the Matterhorn in 1895. And the most noteworthy part of that climb for her was that she wore knickers doing it and was probably the first woman climber ever photographed in knickers.
What an outrage.
Oh, it was. That was considered quite radical.
You know, I didn't realize until reading this book that the question, why climb, is cliché almost to the point of being a bit tedious to a mountain climber. But still, of course, I have to ask it. Particularly with these climbing pioneers, climbing 100 years ago and now seems so difficult and so solitary and so risky. Why do they do it?
The answer that I think they would give is it's fun. If you don't die, you have a good time most of the time.
Gee, that's fun.
But you're right. It's physically extremely arduous as well as risky, particularly when you are dealing with terrain that is unknown, as these women were. But I think they did it because at that time, in the Victorian era, their lives were fairly constricted in what they were able to do and how they could express themselves physically. And even though most of them were women of means financially, they still had fairly defined and restrictive roles. So what better way to see the world from a new vantage point than on top of a mountain?
Rebecca Brown is the author of Women on High, Pioneers of Mountaineering, published by AMC Books. She joined me from New Hampshire Public Radio. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Pippin. My pleasure.
Share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing to oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Of maneuvering skis and poles into my van for ski trips and putting on stiff, shin-banging boots, snowboarding looked so simple. It was almost impossible to find a snowboarding convert who wasn't anything short of rhapsodic.
Ah. Ow!
So, reluctantly, on a trip to the slopes last season, I gave snowboarding a try. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you I hated it. First of all, strapping your feet sideways onto a board and then manipulating it with a rocking heel-toe movement is completely counterintuitive. Besides, continually falling hard on your butt really hurts. Snowboarding was just too much punishment for my 46-year-old body to take. I abandoned the lightweight board and cushy boots in disgust and went crawling back to my beloved skis. Until my most recent trip to Stratton Mountain in Vermont, where my 40-something friend Myra leveled a dare.
You haven't even tried it?
I've tried it, and I hate it.
You should really do the LTR.
LTR. That means learn to ride. It's one of the latest snowboard rages. It features a board specifically designed for the first day out. It doesn't steer as well as a real board, but its soft edges are intended to cut way down on crashes. I'm pretty excited by the prospect that the Wonder Board might correct my incompetence, so I sign up for the LTR class.
First time riding?
Sort of.
Unfortunately, my first encounter is with Brian Spears, the director of Stratton Snowboard School. The LTR technology, he admits, is a strategy to keep aging skiers from getting bored. But the new boards conquer only half the battle for the, mature learner.
That part of your brain down in the stem that is just designed to sit there and keep you alive doesn't really get this whole sliding on the snow thing on the first day. That part of your brain thinks you're a moron for trying this. And it just takes enough time to convince yourself, basically, that you're not going to die, that you're going to be okay.
You know, I think that part of my brain lives in my butt.
We got 10.
10, sweet, 3 of you. Goodbye. 4 of you. Goodbye.
Waiting for class to begin were lots of edgy older students, like 38-year-old Kate Lucchini, mother of 3 snowboarding boys.
You'll never learn any younger. This is what my father used to say. Get out and do it. Yeah, we can do it. We just might be more brittle than the younger people.
People like our flexible-looking instructor, Rockne Zillman, a zealous 20-year-old. It's only fear, I swear, that makes me want to hold on to him as we slip and slide pathetically down the bunny hill.
I got you. See, you're doing great. Okay.
Yeah.
Good slide. Now to a stop. Awesome.
Didn't fall. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay. Heel turn.
As the morning wears on, so do we. I'm covered in sweat, but starting to catch on. For example, I can finally get up from a sitting position. It's so hard to get up.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't.
Come on, get up.
Oh, it's like abs of steel.
Yes.
By lunchtime, I'm beginning to find a groove. In a moment of overconfidence, I think I might be ready to outfit myself in some nasty, that means good, snowboard duds. I don't know if it's the headbanger music or the baggy urban-style outfits, but I suddenly feel old. The shopkeep, a guy named only Zimmer, insists the sport is 95% image.
And the reason that is because if you look good, you feel good. And if you feel good, you're going to ride better. So if you feel good in those clothes, if you feel comfortable, roll with it.
Easy for him to say. I wonder, do I really have the stamina to become a gray on a tray? That's the term for older boarders. For comfort, I seek the advice of the few people who look roughly my age toting snowboards at the base area. 38-year-old Joe Novella recommends ample body protection. I ask him if he's wearing a cup.
No, I'm not. But my wife did buy me pads for my bun, my backside.
Can I see them?
No, I didn't wear them today.
Oh.
You see them. You can't see my buns, I'm sorry.
Bun protectors. Like, I really want to do this sport? I don't have a choice when class resumes with a trip up the chairlift. Clicking into our boards at the start of a long run, Kate, fresh from an encounter with her three boarding boys, helps me understand that with the bottom of the hill so far away, failure is not an option.
I just want to prove I can learn something new.
And I'm not so old that Mom can't learn something new.
I know they're going to be saying, like, you're buff, Mom.
I doubt it.
I don't, because to our collective amazement, we really are learning to ride. We even kind of kick, well, butt. Yes. Before my next trip to the slopes, I'm going to get myself my own board. Maybe some of those winterized clothes from the hood, too. And I'm going to start a campaign to replace the term gray on a tray with something much more complimentary for us seasoned snowboarders. Something like mogul masters. Or, I know, how about midlife boarder? It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com, and from Nutter McLennan and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by All Good Organics Real Food Energy Bars, certified organic on-the-go nutrition from whole food ingredients like fruit, nuts, and grain, available at Whole Foods, Shaw's, and Star Markets. Executive Auto Glass, installing original factory glass and sealants with certified technicians to help ensure the safety of their customers. 1-800-NEW-GLASS. In sports, the Boston Bruins are now 1-4-1 on a seven-game road trip after losing to the Devils in New Jersey last night. The final score was 3-2. The Celtics are off until Monday when they host the Houston Rockets. And the New England Patriots have released wide receiver Donald Hayes after one season with the team. The Providence Bruins have extended their home ice winning streak to 18 games with a rout of the Lowell Lock Monsters of 6-0 last night. The forecast today and right into tonight, breezy with rain, mixing with freezing rain or snow to start out, especially in the interior where a winter weather advisory is in effect. Then across the region, rain right through the day and rain and sleet tonight. Little or no snow accumulation is expected, but road conditions are expected to be hazardous. There is a chance of a thunderstorm on Cape Cod tonight. Temperatures steady throughout this period in the 30s. Tomorrow, scattered showers or sleet to start out. Chance of a thunderstorm on the Cape, then mostly cloudy with a chance of more rain and windy across the region. High temperatures in the mid-40s. Monday, mostly cloudy, a chance of snow showers and cooler. High temperatures in the mid to upper 30s. 36 degrees right now in Boston, 34 in Yarmouth, and on Martha's Vineyard. This is WBUR.
I'm Pippin Ross in for Bill Littlefield, who's busy practicing his audition to be the new Boston Breakers PA announcer. Really, I'm not kidding, folks. Ahead on Only a Game, the game's Titans play, but which no one sees. But first, the news of the week with Charlie Pierce. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Pippin.
The NBA trade deadline came and went Thursday evening, and at the very last minute, longtime Seattle Supersonic point guard Gary Payton went east. Did that surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me that Payton got traded. They were looking to unload him and his salary.
and we're quite clear about that from the beginning of the season. It did strike me as odd that Ray Allen, who has been the identity of the Milwaukee Bucks for the past 4 or 5 years, was traded so easily to Seattle. That was a remarkable price to pay for Gary Payton, who's on the downhill side of his career. I don't know what this is going to do to the Milwaukee Bucks. I don't think they're anywhere near. 2 years ago, they were no worse than the second contender in the East, and I don't think they're any better than the fourth right now.
On Thursday, Baltimore Orioles owner Pete Angelos called on Major League Baseball to pretty much join every other league and the Olympics to ban ephedrine, which was a major suspect, of course, in the death of Orioles pitcher Steve Beckler. Why didn't baseball ban this a long time ago?
The biggest problem that we have that you have in banning something like this is that it's legal. And it's hard to connect the dots between something that's legal everywhere else in the society and banned for sports. I think you're going to see some moves in Congress to ban these things on the national level. With all due respect to Steve Beckler, there were a number of different factors contributing to his death. He had a borderline high blood pressure. He had diagnosed liver abnormalities. He was not a very healthy player. But I would hate to see his death used as a club in the labor management fight.
So I've got a wire in front of me here, and the Tyson-Etienne fight it's on again.
It's off. It's on.
No, it's off.
It's off. It's on. It's off again. I have no idea. Mike Tyson has now decided that in his late age, he's going to look like Queequeg from Moby Dick. You know, I would think, though, and I don't have any expertise in the subject, I would think that right before you're entering a fight in which you're liable to get hit in the face a couple times, it's probably not the best time to get a new tattoo on your face.
Really?
I don't know what's going to happen here. This fight will come off or it won't come off. People will watch or they won't watch. Clifford the Black Rhino ATN is going out of his way to act as nutty as his opponent.
Okay, as Annika Sorenstam was telling the world that she was looking forward to playing her first PGA event in May, 31-year-old golfer Brian Kontak announced that he will attempt to qualify for July's U.S. Women's Open at Oregon's Pumpkin Ridge. Excuse the expression, I guess, but is this some kind of weird tit-for-tat? I can't believe I said that.
Well, I don't know. I think Brian Kontak is thinking with his tat, to be perfectly honest with you. Look, the differences are obvious. Annika Sorenstam is being invited to take a sponsor's exemption from the sponsors of the tournament, probably as a means of promoting the Colonial. Brian Kontak is attempting to qualify in a format, the organization of which requires that the entrant be a female professional or female amateur. He says he's going to try to work around it. I smell an awful lawsuit. I smell the usual knee-jerk, you're discriminating against us because we discriminate against you rhetoric. Brian Kontak's attempt is going to be, at the very least, another bone to be chewed in the culture wars. Annika Sorenstam's thing is a great event, and I'm looking forward to it.
Speaking of controversy, the latest one at Augusta had to do this week with getting protest permits. You really think this thing's going to turn nasty?
I think it's already turned nasty. The protesters have to apply for a permit 20 days in advance. This goes along, by the way, with the general motif in the country where various governmental bodies make protests impossible by making them exceedingly difficult to organize. Twice in the month, the Richmond County Commission has failed to adopt these new regulations, and the committee's vote has split completely down racial line. Mayor Bob Young, who's a white man, cast a deciding vote to break the 5-5 tie. The black members of the commission think back to the civil rights days, which are, believe it or not, not all that long ago, and think that this is just an attempt to restrict the right of people to express their displeasure with Augusta. They're probably right. This is going to get messier before it gets cleaner.
Now, I don't get this. Jack Nicklaus said this week that advances in golf equipment could make Augusta obsolete. What does that mean?
It means you can hit the ball farther and straighter, and so far and straight that the various traps and pitfalls of Augusta don't come into play because you simply hit the ball over them. There's been talk about this ever since Tiger Woods won the Masters in 1977 and made the golf course look silly in doing so. And they've already tricked that course up about as much as topography can allow. If Jack Nicklaus is right, then the Masters will become sort of this quaint monument to old golf, because if the equipment does get better and Nicklaus is right, it will become an obsolete golf course.
Wednesday, the University of Connecticut women's basketball team won their 64th straight game, beating Miami 81-60. They play Notre Dame tomorrow. You think the Huskies are going to go undefeated?
Well, they had to come from behind, believe it or not, against Miami, which I don't believe they've had to do for about 8 years now. They've beaten everybody they have to beat. They've beaten Tennessee, who's number three. They've beaten Duke, who's number two. They've got Notre Dame. Then they're at Georgetown, at Providence. They have West Virginia at home. None of those teams should give them a problem. They're going to get through the season undefeated, and then they're going to have to beat a whole bunch of teams they've already beaten in the women's national tournament.
So you can count Iowa State basketball coach Larry Eustace among those who feel college athletes should be paid. He says he's even willing to put his own money where his mouth is. Is that a good idea?
It's an interesting idea. Of course, it comes on the heels of the bill requiring the University of Nebraska to be paid a stipend. It's another indication that the system is cracking and that there better be something in place when it finally collapses, or the chaos that's going to ensue when it does collapse, and it will collapse, is going to be beyond anyone's control.
Finally, Charlie, your favorite topic, the endorsement money, keeps rolling into the Tiger Woods camp. His caddy will now wear a Valvoline logo on his shirt sleeve during the tournaments. Kind of an odd allegiance, isn't it?
Well, Steve Williams races cars in New Zealand when he's not carrying Tiger's bag. And, of course, people who race automobiles pick up endorsements on the way to pick up their cornflakes in the morning. He did have to clear it with Tiger and Nike, of course. And he will continue to wear a Nike hat, so I guess the world will continue to spin on its axis.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe magazine and drills for Crude each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
I can't help it. Well, I'm a rolling daddy with a mean machine. It's got to be a motor. It sure is clean. I'm a hot rod man. Yeah, I'm a hot rod man. Well, look out, little mama. Gonna get you if I can. I got a cowboy caddy with a custom seat. It's leatherette. They're all rolled in pleat. Come on, little mama, sit by my side. You and your daddy gonna go for a ride. I'm a hot rod man.
He's a hot rod man.
Oh, I'm a hot rod man.
He's a hot rod man.
Look out, little mama, gonna get you if I can. Oh, Bobby, wind it up.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter if you visit Only a Game's website at onlyagame.org.
We're gonna head for the driving on the edge of town. We're gonna look real cool as we tool around. All the fellas gonna scream and shout. When I leave, I'm gonna be alone out. I'm a hot rod man.
Hot rod man.
I'm a hot rod man. I'm gonna get you if I can. Oh, Billy Hancock, go, go.
With rare exception, American Olympians are quickly forgotten when the games are over and not thought about again during the long 206 weeks between the games. But the United States Olympic Committee is attempting to change that by promoting and showcasing what are known as power and combat sports: boxing, fencing, shot put, wrestling, weightlifting, judo, karate, and taekwondo. Jason Margolis recently attended the first such attempt and filed this report from San Jose, California.
A half hour into the first daytime event at the inaugural Titan Games, exactly 44 people sit in the temporary stands erected in the center of San Jose State's campus. A hard rock band warms up the crowd as five of the world's best shot putters loosen up by tossing their 16-pound stones on the campus lawn.
Well, that doesn't get you up in the morning. I don't know what's going to.
The Titan Games are off to a humble start.
The biggest challenge with the Titan Games is just it's a first-time event. Whenever you're trying to market a first-time event, whether it's to sponsors or fans or even to get a broadcaster on board, the challenge is being able to share with them your vision and get them to see the possibility of what it can be.
Keith Allo is the chief of entertainment properties for the United States Olympic Committee. It was his job to market the Titan Games, to craft an edgier package that would sell the more obscure Olympic summer sports to fans, sponsors, and athletes.
What the Olympic Games does, we can't emulate. You can't emulate the Kentucky Derby. I don't care if you do get the best horses in the field. You can't recreate that kind of tradition. You can't recreate the Olympic Games. So we're not trying to.
Attention to the competition floor as we are about to begin.
Titan Games are a far cry from the Olympics. With flashing lights, loud PA announcers, and a steady barrage of Twisted Sister, Guns N' Roses, and Poison, it feels more akin to a WWF wrestling match than the Olympics. Inside the San Jose State Event Center, it's a four-ring circus with wrestling, boxing, and martial arts in three rings, and then either fencing or weightlifting on a stage overlooking it all. Bells, whistles, and buzzers fill the air as the best athletes in the world compete side by side. Russian wrestlers, the Korean Taekwondo team, and Hungarian weightlifters all battling in a USA versus the world format. It's entertaining, confusing, and a tad overwhelming for both participant and fan. Despite the cacophony, fencing fan Paul Shao is able to concentrate on his favorite sport.
Luckily, I'm not that interested in that side of the arena, so I've been able to kind of, like, watch over here, and I don't know if I missed anything big. If I did, I don't feel so bad.
Like many in the crowd, 23-year-old Shao is here to see his event of choice, but he's gaining an appreciation for a new sport, Taekwondo.
I don't know, it's great because you can just kind of, in between the breaks of one, you can move on to another one. And I guess if you're into action, it's pretty much nonstop action. All you gotta do is turn your head and see something else.
This was exactly the strategy of the Titan Games organizers. Get sports fans in the building, and maybe they learn to appreciate something new. Steve Brunner, a director of marketing at the USOC, originally came up with the concept for the Titan Games to showcase some of the traditionally overlooked Olympic sports. The idea was to create what he calls an Olympic sampler, because eight sports together can generate more interest than one alone.
Singularly, with the exception of maybe boxing, all these sports would be, you'd have a hard time drawing 5,000 fans, unless maybe wrestling, you know, in Iowa or something like that. But I think it's, nowadays, you need a little bit of a hook, I think, to get the general curiosity seeker or general sports fan into the venue or get people interested in what you're doing.
Brunner says the USOC planners had to be careful not to sensationalize the Olympic movement in order to make a sport more appealing. But he adds, it's a risk the USOC had to take.
Are we pushing the envelope a little bit with what we're doing? Yeah, we are. But I think nowadays, if we're trying to appeal to a younger generation, we need almost multiple stimulations going on at the same time, whether it's the presentation of the sports, whether it's the music. If you go into any other professional sporting event, with the exception of probably golf or tennis, where you have to be really quiet, we think that's a way that we've got to present these sports.
While Brunner and the USOC hope the Titan Games will increase the popularity of more obscure sports, he says the ultimate goal is to provide elite international competition for American athletes. For those like freestyle wrestler Tina George, the Titan Games are a rare opportunity to show off her sport. Female wrestling will be an Olympic medal event for the first time in Athens next year. So the Games are also an opportunity to practice against top Russian wrestlers. It's also a chance for George to get used to the attention.
It was really exciting. I've never been a part of anything this big or, you know, this exciting. The whole crowd and was just so energetic, and everyone's so excited to be competing and have all the other sports. Because I was watching other sports like, oh, my God, it hurts to get kicked like that, or it hurts to punch. And I was like, I'm glad I don't do those sports.
On the final evening of the Games, a near sellout crowd of 4,150 cheers on U.S. weightlifter Shane Hammond as he closes the Games with one final successful clean and jerk, even though he had already won the weightlifting competition.
Oh, man. I definitely wasn't expecting to go that high, but when the crowd won a 500 and they were just chanting it, I just had to go for it. And when I went out, man, I was just psyched. I mean, it was such a, you know, exciting. It just totally pumped me up, man. The crowd was huge in that attempt. They really were.
At the end of the competition, Shane Hammond shared the ultimate Titan award with Cuban wrestler Yoel Romero and U.S. weightlifter Cheryl Haywood. The USOC will evaluate the Titan Games in the weeks to come and may introduce other thematic multi-sport festivals, possibly one involving winter sports like bobsled, luge, and skeleton. or a Reach the Beach event tailored for water sports. For Only a Game, I'm Jason Margolis in San Jose, California.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from John Hoder and from Keith Infantino. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287 toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield.
And now, fans of the beautiful game, the world game, your Boston Breakers!
Not bad, Bill, but keep your day job. WUSA teams only play 11 home games a year. I'm Pippin Ross. Bill Littlefield will return next week. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National...